3, 2, 1. When it became clear the federal government would recognize tribes in Alaska, Native rights advocates formed the Alaska Intertribal Council to represent their interests. Alaska Natives are currently organized under the Alaska Federation of Natives, but that group is weighted toward corporations created by Congress some 25 years ago to settle land claims. Interim Chairman Will Mayo says the Intertribal Council can advocate for a government-to-government relationship in a way that the AFN cannot, and he hopes to further the council agenda by contracting for federal programs not currently administered by Natives.
The Alaska Intertribal Council is interested in looking at contracting for those programs so that it would be a statewide tribal consortium that would take over, like the Alaska Native Medical Center, other what we call essential statewide services.
Mayo says the AITC is pursuing a joint partnership to manage the $70 million Alaska Native Medical Center scheduled for completion next year. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Northern Television has announced the end of a 40-year relationship with the CBS television network. President Hank Hove says Channel 11 dropped the number 3 network after CBS lost the NFL to Fox.
That was a real blow to us. This is a football town, and when you don't have football as the centerpiece of your sports schedule for the year, you're really missing an essential element of television, and the ability to sell and market it is somewhat curtailed.
By entering into a long-term contract with NBC, Hove says KTVF will have a much stronger sports component, including NFL football, the Summer Olympics, Major League Baseball playoffs, and the World Series. With ABC on Channel 2 and NBC soon taking a lead role on Channel 11, some CBS programming will be seen on each of the local stations, and some CBS programs will just disappear.
So there will be some loss in that sense, though it will be replaced by offerings of equal or perhaps, I would hope, even greater attraction.
Hove says what he calls the local component, a strong local news program, and responsiveness to what the community wants, keeps local broadcasting healthy.
The success of the game in this business will be determined by the amount of commitment that a local station is going to make to its local community. If it doesn't have that, then I fear that probably the future is not altogether too bright.
Viewers will see NBC more on Channel 11 after the 1st of April. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. Phil Graham says he's the fellow who's come looking for a job, and he says he's the man who can beat Bill Clinton next fall. He's a former conservative Democrat and two-term Republican senator from Texas, and if clapping is any sign, the 200 people who had breakfast at the Westmark Gold Room Saturday liked what he said. The senator's folksy and relaxed speech was interrupted 43 times by applause in just 30 minutes, as he described why he, not Bob Dole or Bill Clinton, should be the next president. Graham said he's committed to protecting and expanding freedom and opportunity for every American. He reinforced repeatedly his belief that not Washington, but American families should be making the nation's decisions around their own kitchen tables.
I think Washington has too much to say about how your income is spent, about how your business is run, about how your land is used, about how your children are educated, and I mean to take that power back from Washington and give it back to your family. So that you can make those decisions for yourself again every night around your kitchen table.
The author of the Graham Rudman Act vowed to balance the budget in 4 years or not run again. He said he'd abolish the inheritance tax, cut tax rates, and institute a flat tax.
Now, I know all next year that President Clinton is going to say during the election, if you elect Phil Graham, he will cut tax rates and rich people will exploit the situation by investing their money, and if they're successful, they will earn profits. And I'm going to say, very respectfully, welcome to America, Mr. President.
Praising what he called his mama's America, where people work hard and fulfill their own dreams, Senator Graham said he is angry that his mother has bars on her windows and can't go for a walk at night. He promised safer streets, tougher sentences, and a no-frills prison system.
I'm going to make prisoners work 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. I'm going to make them go to school at night. So when they get out of prison, they're going to have a skill they learn by working in prison. They're going to know how to read and write, and they're not going to be in any hurry to do something that will get them sent back to prison.
Graham said the current welfare system makes mothers dependent, drives fathers out of the house, and denies people access to the American dream. He praised immigrants who roll up their sleeves and who work hard, and he says he wants to cut payments to those who won't. He wants to stop subsidizing women who have children on welfare and out of wedlock. Instead of abortion, the senator calls for a streamlined adoption program.
I realize that the life issue is a controversial issue even within our party, but that's how I feel about it. I will fight to preserve the Reagan pro-life plank in our platform, and it will not be changed if I am the Republican nominee for President of the United States.
Wrapping up, Graham said there are really only two issues for Republicans after Christmas, and those boil down to two questions.
Number one, who can beat Bill Clinton? And number two, who will change America if they get this job? And so as not to leave you in any suspense, the answers are Phil Graham Pilgrim. And let me explain why.
He can do it, he says, with a coalition of conservative Democrats, independents, Republicans, and blue-collar workers. A blue-collar Republican himself, coming out of a poor Texas family, who made good by hard work and persistence, he says he can talk to the people, and he says he will stand by his convictions. Senator Phil Graham is hoping his positions and his convictions will put him ahead in Alaska's straw poll coming up January 29th, and then over the top in November. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Three, two, one. When it became clear that the Clinton administration was going to recognize 226 villages as tribes, tribal advocates started to organize. They formed the Alaska Intertribal Council. Interim Chairman Will Mayo says members wanted to build an organization with a government-to-government orientation, different, therefore, from the Alaska Federation of Natives.
AFN has a very large corporate membership, and it's not a criticism, it's just the way it is, that corporate issues aren't always the same as tribal issues, and where they are, there's can be conflicts.
As an example, Mayo cites the failed attempt to amend the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to enable Native corporations to transfer lands to tribal councils. The idea was to protect lands from potential loss through corporate bankruptcy and to promote the cause of Indian country. While AFN initially supported the idea, it backed off for political reasons when it was clear Congress wouldn't accept the change. More recently, many tribal advocates found they were on the losing end of another debate, this time when the AFN endorsed oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So in an attempt to make the tribal voice more prominent, AITC delegates moved to work more closely with the AFN when addressing Alaska Native issues with federal and state governments. All differences aside, AFN spokesman John Tetpon says both organizations stand to gain through cooperation.
Even though there are probably some differences of opinion, I think that there are common goals that are represented by the corporations and the nonprofit associations that we have in the state.
Tetpon says the corporations have many shareholders who advocate for tribal status, and they'll be able to use their influence to help direct their corporations towards self-governance.
I think the way in which the corporations are set up, the shareholders hold some pretty good influence on the way that corporations are run and operated, and those shareholders, for the most part, are members of tribal governments and tribal organizations.
But while the AITC and AFN have similar missions, their budgets are light years apart. The AITC is run on a relative shoestring, and to gain status, Mayo says the organization's trying to get management contracts for some statewide health programs funded by the federal government.
The Alaska Intertribal Council is interested in looking at contracting for those programs so that it would be a statewide tribal consortium that would take over, like the Alaska Native Medical Center, other what we call essential statewide services.
Mia says the AITC is only interested in those programs not now run by Native organizations. To that end, the AITC has begun talking about a partnership with the Alaska Native Health Board to co-manage the $70 million medical center. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Three, two, one. This month, Charles Deere has been tabulating the Geophysical Institute's hits and misses at forecasting the aurora. Every week, the Institute creates maps showing how far south the aurora will be visible. Then they send maps to media outlets and chambers of commerce across Alaska and Canada. After running his calculations, Deere says most of their predictions have been on the money.
We're off about 25% of the time, so I guess we could say that we're 75% accurate. This is due to various reasons, but mainly it's just the variability of the sun, and it's just something we can only guess at this point.
Deere is talking about one of the factors that got scientists into the aurora forecasting business a year ago. The sun is in a relatively quiet period with repeating patterns of solar eruptions. These eruptions, in turn, spew the charged particles out that strike the Earth's magnetic field, igniting the aurora. As predictable as these eruptions are right now, the sun still acts erratically, throwing off the forecasts. And in years to come, things will get more chaotic. Still, Deere says, a year ago they feared when the sun's quiet period ended, so would the predictions.
When the sun becomes more active in a couple of years, we'll understand a lot more of what's going on as far as the forecast is concerned, and that we'll be able to forecast into that time in the solar cycle when the storms are more sporadic or spontaneous and are difficult to predict.
Deere also credits the global network of instruments that measure the Earth's magnetic field. By way of the Internet, geophysicists now get this data daily. And Deere says the more data, the better when forecasting. That's a point backed up by Ted Fathauer with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. He says when meteorologists first scanned satellite images regularly in the mid-70s, storm forecasting accuracy jumped. But he also says only the public can measure a forecast's accuracy.
Forecasts have to be gauged by the people who use them. If, for instance, a pilot in Kodiak of a fishing vessel wants to know at least 24 hours ahead of time if there is going to be an end to poor weather, that is really what's relevant. If that same fisherman wants to know at least 24 hours in advance when good weather will turn to bad, then that is the criterion by which forecasts should be judged.
For now, only a few rocket scientists need extremely accurate aurora forecasts. But judging by the 2,000 Internet users who visit the Geophysical Institute's forecast webpage a week, a fair number of people are interested in their prognostications. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Every nonprofit is... You ready? Yeah. Every nonprofit is looking for some way to get ahead, with big grants or small fundraisers, whatever will keep the lights on and the programs running. This fall, one local organization came up with a substantial goal, one they hoped they'd get a lot of help with. John Cezada is the executive director of the Fairbanks Youth Center Boys and Girls Club.
We wanted to create a a inclusive community fundraising activity that everyone could get involved in. And we tried to figure out the thing that everybody has that we could use that they may not necessarily need, and we came upon pennies.
Since just before Thanksgiving, they've been collecting hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands, and as of yesterday, Zazada said they had collected and bagged and banked 750,000 coins. For the past 3 years, the youth club has been offering programs for adolescents. The million pennies, $10,000, will go to keep things going and to do some repair work.
We're fundraising both to support the general programs of the Boys and Girls Club, our academic support programs, employment programs, open sports programs, and our community center downtown in Main School, as well as the renovations that we're doing to create a modern Boys and Girls Club out of a 70-year-old school building.
Donations have been coming in from individuals, families, schools, and small businesses, and by tonight at 7, Zazada thinks they'll be over the top, but maybe not overwhelmed.
We're expecting lots of people to bring in their pennies, and that we're going to get a little bit behind, but we have a real kind bank helping us out, and here in the next few days they'll be able to absorb them.
The Youth Center is holding a holiday open house from 4 to 7 today to celebrate what they hope is a successful fundraiser. There'll be a big tote board on the wall down at Main School to help them count down or up to the last penny. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. Last spring, ozone density over Alaska was roughly 10% below historic values. But UAF Associate Chemistry Professor Dan Jaffe says that's only part of the story.
Ozone this past spring, from March, April this past year, was one of the worst years on record in the Arctic. The ozone depletion was most bad over the European and Scandinavian region of the Arctic, where they had up to about 40% loss of the ozone. That's a really dramatic amount of ozone loss, probably the worst on record.
Jaffe says in the southern hemisphere, ozone levels this fall were also at record lows, less than half the level 30 years ago. Scientists are concerned because ozone blocks ultraviolet radiation from the sun. George Washington University professor Edward DeFabo says UVB is known to cause a number of human health effects.
The main concerns at the moment are a potential for an increase in skin cancer, a potential for an increase in eye cataracts. There are certain kinds of cataracts that are influenced by UVB radiation, and some down modulation, or what we call suppression, of certain parts of the immune system.
While people can get some protection from using sunblock, DeFabo says such products don't counteract UVB's immune suppression effects. So no matter how much sunblock you use, if you're in the sun, your body can't fight the effects of more exposure. It's well known that UVB exposure damages cell function and promotes mutation, leading to cancer in humans. But DeFabo says researchers have relatively little information on how ecosystems respond.
The big question is, how much UVB is too much? What levels of UVB are plants and animals and people going to be able to tolerate before they begin to see these damaging effects? The answer, unfortunately, is we don't know, and we don't know because of the very limited amount of research that's been done on effects.
Although research money's been difficult to find, several nations have signed agreements to reduce their use of ozone-damaging chemicals. UAF's Jaffe says the so-called Montreal Protocol is a good first step, but with all the chlorofluorocarbons still being used, restoring the ozone layer will take more than international agreements.
That means that the ozone hole problem, both in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, is going to continue to get worse for about another 5 to 10 years, and then it will start to get better. Provided that all of the countries that have signed on to the Montreal Protocols keep their word that there's limited black market trading in the chlorofluorocarbons, and very importantly, that the developing countries like China and India agree to participate in not using the old chlorofluorocarbons and use the more modern chemicals that are being developed.
Until the ozone layer is repaired, researchers are looking for more money to find out how the depletion will affect plants and animals. During meetings last week in New Hampshire, the International Arctic Science Committee endorsed a research program to look into the issue. DeFabo plans to use that endorsement as a lever to find more research money. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Two. 21 months after she was beaten and severely injured in San Cristobal Verpaz, Guatemala, Fairbanks and June Weinstock remains affected by her injuries. Friend and guardian Ronnie Rosenberg says Weinstock depends on the help she receives in a Fairbanks long-term care center.
June continues to be in stable condition at the Denali Center and is still needing the support that she's able to get there, the therapy.
Weinstock was traveling in Guatemala when she was attacked and viciously beaten by a mob of people who believed she had stolen a child. The missing child was later found unharmed. Five of the men who attacked and battered her were convicted of attempted murder and infliction of serious injury. This week, they were sentenced to 26 years in prison. Five others were charged as accessories in the battering. They received 14-year sentences. Both sentence terms are irreducible. A lower court originally acquitted the 10 men, but when the American embassy protested, they were retried on appeal by the Guatemalan government. Rosenberg says she has not paid much attention to what's happening in Guatemala.
I would hope that their justice system works, and I know that the American embassy has told me that they were pursuing the matter, and it appears that they have.
22 people in all have now been convicted and sentenced in the attack. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. Every time somebody buys a big game tag, hunting or fishing license, or guns or ammunition, some part of the fee goes to fish and wildlife management, habitat preservation, or public education. In Alaska, when both state and federal user fees are combined, about $16 million goes to the state division of wildlife conservation. People who hunt, trap, or fish have a real interest in species conservation, but wildlife users have felt more could be done if more people were asked to pay. Dick Bishop is the executive director of the Alaska Outdoor Council.
One of the longstanding dilemmas, I guess, that people have puzzled over is how to share the financial responsibility for wildlife management, fish and wildlife management.
Not yet, but soon more people may underwrite such programs. An association of wildlife conservation agencies is working on a user fee aimed at outdoor enthusiasts, hikers, bird watchers, campers, kayakers, and others. Jaron Bruce, the legislative liaison for Fish and Game, says the fee would be attached to equipment.
Binoculars, spotting scopes, cameras, film, tents, outdoor recreation equipment, canoes, cooking stoves, backpacks, things like that would be subject to a small excise tax at the manufacturer's level, which would be collected at the federal by the federal government.
Bruce says much like hunting and fishing fees, the feds would route revenues to the states.
There are many good arguments for this. It's a relatively small amount of money. It's a user pay type revenue collection system. It's administered at the local level, at the state level, so it's very responsive to the local residents' concerns and wishes.
To succeed, this idea needs support from Congress, but also from manufacturers and retailers who will have to pass the cost along, and from people who buy outdoor gear. Dick Bishop says hunters and fishers may have reservations because they buy the same gear.
The downside of it is that they no doubt would continue using those things, so they would wind up being taxed for purchases of those items in addition to whatever their taxes are for, like, hunting licenses and the federal excise taxes on fishing equipment and hunting equipment and boat gas and so on that they presently pay.
Bishop says he likes a scheme he's heard of in Missouri that places a small state tax on soft drinks and other discretionary purchases. More people pay a little, and more money goes to habitat, fish and wildlife management, and conservation.
I suppose you could raise the same objection. There are people who drink soda pop who don't ever give a second look at a moose or whatever. So that argument could be raised, but it's a very small tax, so it's spread around quite a bit.
If the outdoor gear user fee goes through as planned, it'll fund projects like wildlife viewing programs, habitat education, and management of non-hunted species. Dick Bishop says, given that they'll be double taxed by the new scheme, hunters and fishers would probably like to see a portion set aside specifically to enhance fish and game populations. In any case, with more and more people using wild lands and with shrinking federal and state budgets, agencies will be looking for new sources of revenue. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. While many Alaskans look toward a growing tourism industry to diversify the economy, accommodating that industry is causing a rub of its own that soars especially felt in Denali National Park. Tourism backers want to move more people into the backcountry, and Park Superintendent Steve Martin says managers are evaluating dozens of factors involved in opening a northern route.
A lot of those have been brought up today. What's the best type of access? Who's the access for? Will it satisfy the needs of the tourism industry and independent traveler? If the destination is Kantishnar or Wonder Lake, what will people do while they are there? And how will that impact the current uses on the Park Road, which of course is a world-class experience that that we don't want to do anything to disrupt.
Attempting to move more people without disrupting current park values is a difficult proposition, but Joe Fields, president of Kantishna Holdings, says the best way is to build a railroad from Healy along the Stampede Road out to Wonder Lake. The National Parks Advisory Board endorsed the Northern Rail idea, provided area stakeholders agree on the level of development. Field says compared to extending a road on the south side, the idea is a valid solution to get more people a view of Mount McKinley.
This is the feature that people buy when they're coming to Alaska, and right now it's not delivered. And the big difference between this and the south side that they're talking about is that we're talking about private funding, they're talking about public funding.
Fields proposes to build hotels at each end of the park and to run trains year-round to Wonder Lake. He argues the train would control access and collect head taxes to support park programs. But as much as Fields and others believe in the rail idea, others, like Camp Denali co-founder Celia Hunter, oppose it with equal vigor.
The point is that there are accommodations there which are very adequate for and in keeping with the carrying capacity of that area. But if you start putting you talk about putting world-class hotels in, those people, if they did come in there, their impact on the country would be enormous because they wouldn't care. What they're after is the bottom line. They want to make money.
The divisiveness surrounding the issue of park access is almost as old as the park itself, and various proposals have floated over the years for opening up the Wonder Lake area. So far, development's been limited. When the Alaska Lands Act expanded the park in 1981, it closed off many development doors and frustrated many inholders, including one Mark Wason, owner of 15 acres north of Kantishna.
This is my 11th year of coming to these phony meetings, and that's all they are. It's just to create more studies and more committees, many of which contradict one another, and it's just a delay process is all it is. And everybody in that room will be dead from old age before there's any access to Denali Park.
Wason admits he's cynical, but he speaks for many people frustrated at the way the Park Service has handled the demand for increasing visitation. Park Superintendent Martin plans to take suggestions from this meeting and incorporate them into an access plan, but he admits it will be a number of years before any development proposal makes it to construction. Public comment on the plans being taken through January 12th. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The Denali Highway is unpaved from Cantwell to 21 miles west of Paxson. Last year, DOT dropped plans to pave the highway, and it's come back this year with a resurfacing plan. The two sections of road would get a noisier, rougher surface than regular asphalt paving. Alan LeMaster of Gakona Junction Village Lodge supports the resurfacing plan. He says it's key to opening up the Copper River Valley and Valdez areas to more tourism. LeMaster says people turned away from Denali National Park would have another route they could then take, one that would lead them to eastern Alaska instead of Fairbanks or Anchorage. Another supporter of the plan is Crystal Green, who works at the Paxson Lodge. Green says there'd be more traffic on the Denali if it were paved, and that would be good for business at the lodge. Green also says it would be good for her job-wise, since she does road construction work in the summer. On the opposite side of the issue is Ruth McHenry of Copper Center, who's distributing a petition that opposes any paving or asphalt surfacing of the highway.
The people that I've talked to like the Denali Highway area, the area that surrounds it. They like it the way it is. It's not congested with people. When you drive the road, you have to take it slow. And if the road were paved, it would see a lot more traffic, a lot more people. And so correspondingly, the area surrounding it would become more heavily used.
McHenry says paving the road could turn away tourists and residents who enjoy the highway as it is. She also says there's no vehicle she knows of that can't use the road now.
Some buses do go across. Winnebagos can use it. Small cars can use it. You just can't drive it at 55 miles an hour. You have to take a little slow. It's not going to take 3 hours like it would if it were paved. But you get a lot more out of it the way it is.
DOT is taking public comment on its transportation needs and priorities list through January 8th. The list will help guide the department's new five-year statewide transportation improvement plan.
In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Three, two, one. In the last decade, Tim Wilson says the State Arts Council's budget has been cut nearly 90%. Wilson heads up the council, which funnels state and federal art dollars to artists and organizations across Alaska. But as it receives fewer dollars, the council's found it harder to evenly distribute the money. That's why Wilson was encouraged by the governor's conference on the arts earlier this month. He says the gathering crafted a new vision for Alaska's arts.
Because we can't make as many grants as we once did, and we're going to be developing new kinds of information services, cooperatively promoting the arts and communities, working with other, like the Division of Tourism and Alaska Marine Highways and private business to promote the arts, so that even though we may not be able to make a direct financial impact in these communities and on these arts organizations, we can help them do better financially in their own community.
Wilson also hopes the conference and the new strategies crafted will tell legislators the council's listening to them. And secondly, that art helps fuel local economies and enriches the lives of Alaskans. But Wasilla Representative Vic Coring isn't convinced. A member of the Finance Committee, last year he wanted to zero out arts funding. And nothing he's seen coming from the arts conference changes his mind, because he says art is not an essential state service.
It also goes beyond the issue of economics as far as the limited dollars we have and where do we spend those dollars. It's also an issue of philosophy as far as what should government's role be in funding different services in state government. And I truly believe that if the public wants to have the arts in Alaska or anywhere, that the public would pay for that through a private means.
But local arts advocates say that public art enhances the public good. Tawny Barnaby of the Fairbanks Arts Association doesn't argue with Coring about private sponsorship of art, but she worries that art will be less accessible if all funding depends on corporations and wealthy citizens.
I don't think that private funding for the arts is going to go away. I don't think it ever will. People love art, and people will always make sure that it's going on somewhere. But my concern is that it's not going to be for everyone. So if you don't have a lot of money, you should still be able to enjoy the work that a rich man is enjoying also.
The Arts Council says it's committed to ensuring the public access to art, even as it spends the next few months redefining how it will do that. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. When the university went before the legislature to ask for deferred maintenance money, it essentially handed lawmakers a price list for projects. But the money legislators approved isn't enough to fix the buildings on the list. For example, deferred maintenance improvements to Wickersham Hall were estimated at $1.5 million. UA spokesman Bob Miller says that figure has grown to some $4.7 million.
They're simply concerned that with the costs escalating at that rate, the $20 million for UAF's housing deferred maintenance approved by the legislature this year won't go as far as they wanted it to, and they want to make sure that the university is getting the biggest bang for the buck out of that $20 million.
Miller says part of the blame lies on estimates developed 4 or 5 years ago that the university relied upon when going before the legislature. In the ensuing years, safety codes have been upgraded, as have requirements under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Regent Mike Kelly says problems with lead paint and asbestos also tripled the cost of repairing Lathrop Hall. So before okaying another project, Regents wanted to clarify where the money for Wickersham was coming from.
we thought it best to have an emergency meeting in January so we don't lose the 96 construction season, but also so that we stop this and take a look at, you know, what should some of that those funds be coming from code compliance? Should some be coming from, you know, other funds, ADA, special monies for asbestos abatement, whatever, instead of all out of deferred maintenance?
A date for the January meeting hasn't yet been set. In the meantime, Regents will be trying to explain the situation to lawmakers. Representative John Davies says the university's in an uncomfortable position.
I think the Regents needs to kind of look at, digest what the problem is, figure out exactly where, you know, where it's coming from, and then go back to the, at least back to the leadership of the House and Senate, and maybe the finance committees, and kind of explain to them what their dilemma is.
The Regents have already begun that task. Kelly planned to begin meeting with lawmakers Monday night. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. I sit in the middle of the bedroom floor, clutching a screwdriver so tightly that my knuckles are white, and stare so intently at a smudged sheet of images and words that I wonder why it hasn't ignited. I'm trying to assemble a wooden bench meant for the hallway, and I'm doing it in the bedroom so that my children won't hear the expletives I traditionally use to construct anything more complex than a balsa wood glider. It's times like these when I regret my liberal arts education. First off, I'm supposed to be able to make sense of texts. I've been trained to analyze documents and even deconstruct them if I have to. But as hard as I try, I can't make heads or tails out of these instructions. The words are vaguely English, but I think the Third World scribe who penned them used Beowulf syntax as a model. The phrases are certainly as spare and ambiguous as poetry, and the blurry images aren't much better. Like a Rorschach ink blot, one picture I can see either an abstract rendering of the bench or a GNU giving birth. Another drawing resembles a smashed atom with a bewildering assortment of bolts and screws flying from the bench like subatomic particles. And nothing in my liberal arts education fosters the intuition needed to just throw the thing together. There are people in Alaska who walked into the woods, felled timber, then built cabins from the logs. My next-door neighbor could probably field strip and reassemble a nuclear reactor. But after several hours of mental gymnastics and physical exertion, the bench remains in pieces. It wouldn't be so bad if I could look forward to a long period of R&R after this trial. But in a few weeks, callous relatives will send my kids models and sets, each in its way a mini Manhattan Project. Christmas morning, at the time most parents will be tossing back well-earned eggnogs, I'll be pondering the mysteries of form and function in the back bedroom. Hoping you find everything this season pre-assembled, I'm Robert Hannon.